Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is podcast number 73 for October 26, 2010. My name is Ben Snakoff. I'll be one of your hosts today, and with me today I've got
Dominic Rabier,
David Liu,
and David O'Brien.
We would like to take a brief moment to welcome back David Liu, who has been long absent from our podcast. Everybody say welcome back, David.
Yay!
I'm the ghost of podcasters past.
I'm glad your robot didn't eat you.
Yay! As always, we've got three stories. First, we're going to talk about judicial restraints on internet usage. Second, we're going to talk about the first defendant who managed to score a win in the Righthaven copyright lawsuits. And last of all, we're going to talk about what Twitter can do with our photos. So I'm going to lead off with this judicial restraints on internet usage. So what we've seen happen more and more over the past few years is that as a condition of probation, usually relating to some sort of internet crime, a judge will restrict somebody's ability to do work on the internet. Kevin Mitnick, I think, was one of the first people to have one of these restrictions. The man wasn't allowed to touch a computer for years and years and years. But this case deals with something quite different. This was an appeal from a California juvenile court where a juvenile 15-year-old was found to have been in receipt of stolen property, specifically a motorcycle. He was judged to be delinquent and put on probation, and among his probations were that this juvenile could not use a computer that contained encryption, hacking, cracking, scanning, keystroke monitoring, security testing, steganography, a Trojan or virus. He was prohibited from participating in chat rooms, using instant messages such as ICQ, Facebook or MySpace, and similar communications programs. If he had a MySpace or Facebook page, he had to delete that page, and he could not create a new one. And apparently I said Facebook bake. I meant Facebook. Finally, the juvenile could not use a computer for any other purpose than school-related assignments, and had to be supervised whenever using a computer. And the juvenile appealed the probation conditions because he thought that they were vague and infringed on his First Amendment rights. And luckily, this California Circuit Court of Appeals agreed with him and said that a lot of these were overbroad, that when in this case the crime for which the juvenile was being tried and was being put on probation had nothing to do with computers itself, putting these undue restrictions on his use of computers, which has become a main way to talk about main channel for speech. It was unconstitutional. So first off, does anyone want to take the counter position that the appeals court here was wrong in finding that the trial court, the juvenile court judge, should have had the discretion to put limitations on this child's internet and computer usage?
Sure, I can take that position just for fun. This child has, just like you can restrict the use of a gun by a minor, you should be able to restrict the use of the internet by a minor. Both could be used dangerously, or it could be weapons. So it's not about speech, it's about the technology.
Internet doesn't kill people, people kill people.
Using the internet.
Right.
Just like guns.
Yeah, that's an extreme argument, obviously,
sure.
Because it's difficult to defend without an extreme argument. And I agree with the court. The only thing that worries me about the court's decision is that they seem to say that They left open the idea of banning somebody, even a juvenile, from computer usage if the juvenile's crime was computer related, or even if the juvenile managed to find out about this stolen motorcycle on the internet. And that seems a little extreme for me, that, you know, if the juvenile was communicating with friends who said, listen, we've got a stolen motorcycle, would you like it, you know, via Facebook, it seems unreasonable to ban the kid from using Facebook as a result of that, or, you know, any instant messenger.
I think you might be reading into that just a little bit too much, because I think what the court was saying is that these types of conditions on probation must relate to some sort of future criminality, meaning that they're concerned that this 15-year-old will engage in the future in more crimes that are similar to the ones that he just committed. And if it was the case that he had used the internet in some way to locate a person who would be willing to sell him a stolen item, like in this case it was some type of motorcycle, then that might be a situation where a prohibition on usage of certain parts of the internet, be that certain types of communication mediums, like say if it was MySpace that was used, or if it was ICQ or some other form of IRC, I think that would be a little bit more reasonable. But the point is that it has to relate back to the crime that was committed. And I think what you have suggested was a little reading into it a little too much, because it has to relate back a little bit closer to the crime.
I mean, it seems like there should be some sort of direct correlation to the crime. I'm guessing he had breakfast that morning as well, and you know, you could argue that somehow eating Wheaties that morning led to him being able to purchase this motorcycle in the same way. Although that is also an extreme argument. So tell me, one of you, where my legal fallacy there is.
And I don't think it's any worse than my legal fallacy and my little devil's advocate argument why it should hold. I mean, it basically comes down to causation. But
yeah,
I mean,
the Wheaties were not...
Go ahead.
The Wheaties were not a but-for cause of him getting the receiving the stolen property. You know, even if he did not eat the Wheaties, he still would have bought the received the stolen motorcycle. You know, if he found out about the stolen motorcycle through the internet, there's a much better argument that he would not have received the stolen motorcycle.
I just skimmed the
case. Is that clear?
All right, go ahead. Yeah, well, let's finish that thought.
No, I was done. You go.
Well, you were asking if that was clear to Lou, is it?
Yeah, but in this case, it didn't seem to me there was any proof that it was through the internet that he got the information about the motorcycle, or was there?
I don't believe there was. I was
just
making that argument.
Yeah, I just scanned the case, and I was about to say there's nothing in here that it says that he used the internet. Basically, this was terms of his juvenile probation. Because he's a juvenile, the court has broader discretion to apply whatever sort of things they want, and he agreed to the terms, or rather, he didn't object to the terms of the probation, but then he filed this countersuit saying that the terms are unconstitutional.
And there might be some merit to having these types of conditions on probation for a person who's 15 years old. I'm reading these to possibly suggest that the court was interested in this 15-year-old maybe turning his life around and devoting more time to school. Maybe the way that they were trying to do that was to sort of limit his use of the internet, including his communications with, you know, distractions like communicating with friends over MySpace or Facebook, not paying attention to the homework that he's supposed to be doing, something along those lines.
Sure, but and if you look at the actual terms, like, it's minor shall not use a computer that contains any encryption, hacking, cracking, scanning, keystroke monitoring, security testing, stenography, Trojan or virus software. Well, if he violates that, he violates his probation, and that's pretty damn easy to violate, because most computers have encryption software on them of some variety.
Viruses in the case of Windows machines, right?
Sure.
Yeah, the court actually modified that term to say knowingly use. He may not knowingly use a computer that includes any of those things, as opposed to the strict liability, which would have been ridiculous.
Yeah.
But still, encryption is incredibly common. I mean, any browser made since 1998, you know, usually has some sort of secure method, which is encryption. I mean, there's no way to get around that. You are sending encrypted packets with your credit card number to various websites. And so
yeah.
I am currently using a, you know, software that contains encryption software. So,
well, I mean, he's 15 years old, right? He shouldn't be shopping online with a stolen credit card.
What if he signs onto Gmail using HTTPS? That's encrypted.
Right. Then that would be knowingly using encryption, yeah. So even then, that's troublesome.
That's assuming he understands what the difference between HTTPS and HTTP is, and I think that's a stretch.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the knowing limitation that they when they modified that would have changed those circumstances, certainly. But I think that I read this particular condition to sort of be like a copy-paste out of something that they have been throwing in for conditions on probation for all minors or something like that. I don't know that they try to tailor this specifically for this particular 15-year-old.
I thought the point that they brought up about the fact that, you know, you need the internet to pay taxes was, or you can use the internet to pay taxes, was an interesting point to bring up for a 15-year-old who I'm guessing may or may not be gainfully employed.
Let's see. As a former resident of California, I can tell you that when I was 15 years old, that's the age that you could get a work permit and you could start working a limited number of hours per week. So it's at least possible.
Yeah, I did the same thing. I think when I was 15, I got the whatever it was, blue card, or I forget what it was called in New York, to let you work a certain number of hours a week. So yeah, not unreasonable.
I suppose I was just thinking that the in the original probation, the fact that he could only use computers for school-related assignments under supervision was also rather restrictive because there could be any number of other valid activities he could be doing, like applying for a job or looking for a job or, you know, any other looking for places to do his mandated community service if he had some.
Yeah, looking to volunteer at a Boys and Girls Club or looking to join a Boy Scout pack. I'm sure there are lots of other good things that one could do on the internet.
Also worth noting, I guess, is that the term computer isn't really further defined other than just computer. These days, you know, wireless devices like smartphones can do a lot of the same things that computers are capable of doing. Yeah, that's
would this head prohibit him from using a Nintendo DS? It's certainly a computer.
So, does anyone have any thoughts on the nature of the First Amendment, the First Amendment's protections here? That what rights is it that you exactly have then with the First Amendment and using computers?
Yeah, I don't know if the court was that careful to really spell that out, but it's essentially the computers provide many channels for free speech, and cutting off those channels wholesale is, without it being related to the crime, is where the First Amendment concern really showed its head. So again, if his crime had been hacking into people's computers or stealing identities over the computer, then it would have been more reasonable to restrict his computer usage. The fact that he was prohibited from having protected conversations, First Amendment conversations that are protected under the First Amendment through channels like MySpace, Facebook, ICQ, IRC, that's where the First Amendment concern came in. Any last thoughts before we wrap up this story and move on? Let's start. David Liu?
I think the list of things that he is prohibited from doing is hilarious. I mean, the steganography bit was particularly amusing just because it's such a obscure field and, you know, I can hardly see him using that sort of technology, you know, to hide messages in images and such to steal another motorcycle. The conditions here were, I thought, amusing and probably unjust.
Yeah, it seems like they were taken from some other case where they may have been reasonable restrictions to put on someone. David Liu, David O'Brien, any last thoughts?
Let's see here. I'm looking at my paraphrase notes, but in the conditions they also use the word scanning. And at first, I assume that they meant port scanning or something along those lines, or doing some other type of, you know, security checks to see what ports are left open on an internet connection to a computer. But that could be image scanning too. I mean, that's a pretty awful thing. Using a copy machine is pretty serious.
And Dominic?
All set here.
Okay, I think the next story is David O'Brien, so take it away.
Right, this is about the Right Haven lawsuits, and in particular one lawsuit in which a gentleman named Michael Nelson, who is a realtor in Nevada, had been accused of infringing copyrights. Now, we've talked about Right Haven and this company called Right Haven LLC, which is based, I believe, in Las Vegas, Nevada, or at least in Nevada. A couple of times on the show, we've discussed what they've been doing before. It's Eric Goldman. He's a professor from Santa Clara University at the law school. He's described Right Haven as a serial copyright plaintiff that searches for republications of newspaper articles, acquires the copyrights from participating newspapers, sues the republisher for copyright infringement without any prior notice, meaning there's no cease or and desist orders or letters that are sent or asking the republisher or the person who owns a blog to take something down. And then in the lawsuit, they also seek, in addition to seeking damages, a transfer of the domain name. And then after the lawsuit's already been filed, Right Haven apparently has been sending letters that offer settlements to the defendants and try to get them to settle on the side for an amount of money that looks like it might be less than what's alleged in the lawsuit or something along those lines. And of course, one of these persons was this gentleman named Michael Nelson. He has a realty blog that focuses on, among other things, information about developments in the industry, information for potential and current homeowners, things that are related to, looks like, residential real estate. Back in May 2010, Nelson had partially reproduced an article which was originally published in a newspaper, which also has an online component to it, called the Las Vegas Review Journal. And the article had in fact been posted about a week and a half earlier. Of course, a few weeks after this, Mr. Nelson received the letter indicating that he was being sued in the Federal District Court for the District of Nevada, and among other things, of course, was listed. It was alleged that he committed copyright infringement. Nelson fought back a little bit. He filed a motion to dismiss, and he said that in fact his use of the article or the portions of the article was a fair use of the work, and the court agreed and dismissed the case on this motion to dismiss. Looks like Mr. Nelson has saved himself for the moment on the allegations of copyright infringement, but it turns out he's only one of 157 persons or websites who have been either threatened or sued by this company, Right Haven LLC. As Professor Goldman has noted, this is definitely the new age of serial copyright plaintiffs. So first off, we can talk a little bit more about the case and why this was a fair use. Does anyone want to run down the factors on what constitutes fair use and how it operates in copyright law?
Yeah, sure. I'll tackle that. So, fair use is something that's been codified in statute, and it's 17 U.S.C. Section 107. And the four factors that you consider are the purpose and character of the use, the nature of the original work, the amount of the copyrighted work that was used, and the effect on the potential market for the original copyrighted work. So, in broad strokes, those are the four factors. They're not exclusive, so if you can convince a judge to consider a fifth factor, they can, but I don't think I've ever seen a judge consider a factor that wasn't enumerated. And I've spent a lot of time trying to think of another factor, but every time I've thought of one, it's always kind of tied back to one of the existing four factors.
Right, and so when we talk about the rights that are actually granted under the Copyright Act, we usually refer to them as the exclusive rights that an owner of a copyrighted work gets, and that includes the right to copy, the right to make a derivative work, the right to distribute copies. In the case of audiovisual works, it's the right to perform an audiovisual performance, the right to display a work publicly. For instance, if you have a piece of art which is on canvas and you want to publicly display it, you have the right to do that as the copyright owner, and you also have the right to perform sound recordings publicly. So, in particular, this is getting at the right to copy, of course, possibly the right to make derivative works, and the right to distribute copies in this case. What did the court say about Mr. Nelson's use of the work?
They found it as fair use.
Any factors in particular that weighed heavily in his favor?
They specifically noticed that even though his site was commercial, he only used a little bit of the work, specifically the factual aspect, and didn't really take into the commentary, which would have been original, and he didn't really affect the market for the work at all.
I'm gonna not play devil's advocate, but at the same time take the contrary position to what I think you guys and the readers may think, in that I think the judge was way off base in this decision. Like, ridiculously off base, like reversible off base.
Because
Because for one, and I haven't done an exhaustive search just because I haven't had the time, but I can't think of a single case that I've ever seen, or and in my searches could not encounter, did not find a case where a fair use defense has been used as a ground for dismissal. So traditionally, the fair use defense is a factually intensive thing where you have to look at evidence that people put in, and it's not appropriate on summary judgment most of the time, let alone a motion to dismiss. What this judge is saying is that based on the facts that were in the plaintiff's complaint, there is no way that this wasn't a fair use, which is mind-boggling. I just don't believe that that's possible under
So
the rules of federal procedure.
you're just saying that he's making way too much of a conclusion in a place that he shouldn't be able to make that much of a conclusion.
Yes.
Isn't the standard
That.
for motion to dismiss that you take all the facts in the favor of the party arguing against dismissal?
Yes. That you.
So.
They should have taken all of the facts. What the judge was saying is that taking all of the facts in the plaintiff's complaint as true, this was, without a doubt, 100%, absolutely no chance of it not being a fair use.
Then I agree with you that the judge went too far. I mean, eventually he can come to this ruling, but not yet.
Yeah, furthermore, I think he's considering the wrong market for the effect of the copyrighted use. The effect on the potential market, as much as I despise this argument, I think the case law is pretty settled that it's not the market for the article as a whole, it's the market for the licenses on the article.
Okay, so I could shed some light on this from the opposite direction here. One of the key factors that the court actually decided this case on was that there were only 8 sentences that were copied from the original article, and so the original article was, in part, it was about it had some facts about a new housing program, I think, in Las Vegas, and it also had some sort of colorful commentary that was woven in by the author of the article. When we talk about what is copyrightable subject matter, there's no copyright in factual assertions, but there is copyright in expression that isn't about fact. Maybe it expresses an opinion or some other type of commentary on maybe what the housing program will do in the future.
I hate to interrupt you because normally we try to keep this civil, but the way you describe certain facts can be copyrightable. It's not that there's no, it's that there's no copyright in facts, not that there's no copyright in the expression of facts.
If what he's copied then is mostly the factual substance, and I will admit that, or at least I will concede that there might be some expression which is additionally copyrightable, and that would certainly depend on what exactly has been written. What the court said was that he took the first 8 sentences, and that was really about the housing program, and it had nothing to do with the author's opinion on the housing program. At best, that's if it's highly factual, I don't know that you're going to have much copyright in the rest of the expression that's left over after you take out the factual components of those first 8 sentences.
I don't disagree with you per se. I'm just saying it's way too early to make that decision in this case. And I support the idea of trying to deal with these cases quickly and immediately because, let's face it, right? Haven is they're bringing lots of litigation, they're filing lots of cases. No, nothing that they're doing is particularly good for the system. That being said, I can't wrap my head around granting a motion to dismiss on the basis that this was a fair use.
What's typical then in a w when a court decides a fair use does in fact exist, or whenever the court is ready to make that decision? You've talked about some of the things that they're likely to consider, some of the other documents that are set forth by the parties. What was unfair about this particular procedural instance? Because in a motion to dismiss, the party who's opposing the motion also has a right to reply, correct?
Right, but they can't move beyond what's in the pleading at this point. Things that really should have been considered is effect on the potential market. And in this case, there was, you know, the entire opinion here is 4 pages. And the court, and this is quoting from the opinion, the court finds that Nelson's use of the copyrighted material is likely to have little or no effect on the market for the copyrighted news article. And he says this because it didn't contain the author's commentary. That's, again, missing the point. There was no evidence as to what the. There's nothing that the judge considered about, you know, what the going rate is for licensing use of an article, you know, which you can do. The AP has published guidelines as to how much you know it costs per word that you'd want to copy from an AP article. They're just lots of. It's just I don't know how to explain this better than I already have. It's fair use is a factual consideration, and it doesn't seem appropriate to be dealing with a factual consideration at a motion to dismiss like that.
Dominic?
I mean, I think the heart of Ben's complaint, basically, that this is too early for the judge to make this sort of ruling, because the factual issues cannot be yet resolved, and since they're factual issues, I don't think that if you assume the facts in the favor of Righthaven, then you can say that there's absolutely no way there's fair use. I just don't think that's possible.
This, I mean, the fair use is always, or I shouldn't say always, but it is usually the decision of the judge who determines whether there's fair use in an allegation of copyright infringement. This was bound to happen at some point. We have, according to the pleading, we have the work that the plaintiff is complaining about, that's saying that, look, this person has copied or is violating some of my exclusive rights under copyright. You have the original work. You can set those side by side and compare them. What additional facts in this, Ben, would maybe make you decide this in the other direction? And that's, of course, aside completely from the procedural aspects that you've been talking about.
Not necessarily saying that I would decide in the other direction. I'm saying that this is an inappropriate stage of the case to make that factual determination. Again, I don't really know how else I can state that other than, you know, stating it the way I did. But I mean, there are lots of little things in here. Like, the court finds that the purpose and character of Nelson's blog is both commercial and educational in nature. I haven't seen the complaint, but unless the complaint says that the blog is both commercial and educational in nature, that's not a proper factual determination for the judge to be making right now. In fact, the judge shouldn't be making factual findings at this stage. He should be taking the complaint on the face. And if the complaint said, you know, the defendant's commercial blog says such and such, then the judge should have said the defendant's commercial blog is such and such. There are lots of little things in this opinion that worry me, that the judge isn't taking a motion to dismiss seriously. And by seriously, I mean as a motion to dismiss.
Okay, but before we move on from this, one last point. One of the reasons you can file a motion to dismiss is for something called failure to state a claim under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And in the Copyright Act, specifically the fair use section, it lays out the instance where if you have a fair use of a copyrighted work, it is not copyright infringement. So if you read the statute literally, I don't actually know of any cases out there which have held this, so I'm sort of playing cowboy here a little bit. But if you read the statute literally to say that if something is a fair use of a work, it's not copyright infringement, isn't that like saying you don't have a claim for copyright infringement?
Well, to the same extent that pleading a defense that it's outside the statute of limitations is, you know, a defense to copyright infringement, or, you know, would contradict that, or, well, saying that it's outside of the statute of limitations, or, you know, if it's a tort or whatever it is, contract action. But those are cases where, you know, unless the if the complaint said, you know, on such and such a date, the defendant hit me with a car, and 3.5 years later, outside of the statute of limitations, I filed this suit. That's the kind of thing that you can determine on the face of the complaint whether or not it's within the statute of limitations. And the defendant, if they want to, they can raise, you know, some sort of tolling argument that, you know, they weren't 18 at the time of the accident, or they had injuries that they didn't discover until a later date. But, you know, it's just fundamentally different, that this is a factual determination, that fair use is, you know, an intensely factual determination, as opposed to statute of limitations, which you can just look at the date of the accident or the date of the thing underlying it and the date that the complaint was filed and make a determination based on that.
Okay. I think these are all fair points that you're making here. So important things to note, that there are some procedural aspects to not only motions to dismiss, but also you know, the way that the fact-finding processes work in the court system. There's some other interesting things that we can sort of discuss lightly before we move on, and that Righthaven, as I noted before, has filed 157 lawsuits. According to one website, which is righthavenlawsuits.com, and that's not affiliated at all with the Righthaven LLC or the company who is filing these suits, Righthaven has received over $196,000 in settlement agreements or fees paid by defendants who decided to settle a case rather than litigate it. I think 56 of the 157 cases have actually been settled, so that probably comprises at least all, if not, or most, if not all, of the $196,000. Another interesting thing about Righthaven is that apparently, and I just read this from a couple of articles, they look to see where there might be some sort of infringing material written on a website or a blog, and then go back to the newspapers and negotiate the assignment of the rights to litigate before they actually file the suit. And in some cases, that also involves registering the copyrights prior to the lawsuit. Then they go ahead and file the suit and go through this sort of this process of trying to settle the case outside of court. But again, it's been alleged that they're going primarily after owners of small blogs who are reproducing either in part or in some cases in whole copyrighted works from certain newspapers. And the largest entity that they've been negotiating for these litigation rights from is this newspaper called the Las Vegas Review Journal, which is the same one that was involved in this case. Any other thoughts, guys, before we move on?
So one thing I found interesting was just this, the fact that they were, in addition to monetary damages, also looking to get the rights and have transferred the domain names to them. And that sort of, in my mind, is continuing along the trend of punishments fitting the crimes. I can't see really what taking those domain names would do for Righthaven. I mean, is there some end goal to that other than just screwing with the small companies and blogs?
No, it's a scare tactic. I don't think Righthaven would have any right to get the domain names. To get a domain name, at least under current U.S. law, you'd have to have some sort of trade name infringement, you know, something under the Lanham Act or the Anti-Cybersquatting Consumer Protection Act. And for just copyright, there's no judicial remedy for taking somebody's domain name unless they voluntarily give it up as part of a settlement. I think it's just to scare people.
The one other thing I'd like to do as part of investigating this story is I'd like to just now read a bit from the Las Vegas Review Journal just so that we can find out a little bit more about Righthaven's tactics.
No, that's okay. No, don't. Don't do that.
You guys never let me have any fun. Other than that, I'm all set.
Dominic, any final thoughts?
All set.
Okay, go ahead and take it away for us.
The last story concerns the Twitter Terms of Service. You can actually read these all for yourself at twitter.com/TOS. Specifically, they recently updated these Terms of Service to add this paragraph. You retain your rights to any content you submit, post, or display on or through the services. By submitting, posting, or displaying content on or through the services, you grant us a worldwide, non-exclusive, royalty-free license with the right to sublicense to use, copy, reproduce, process, adapt, modify, publish, transmit, display, and distribute such content in any and all media or distribution methods, now known or later developed. And one blogger actually posted this, speaking to professional photographers, and he basically said that means if you post your photo on Twitter, you've basically given them rights to a non-exclusive royalty-free license, which is what it just says right there. And it means that if you later try to offer someone an exclusive license, you're not going to be able to do that for that particular photo because you've already given Twitter a non-exclusive license. And of course, you can't give an exclusive license when you've already given out a non-exclusive license. So, panel, what do you think of Twitter's terms of service? Specifically, let's focus on professional photography.
Well, in other news, a person who's using Twitter has read the terms of service agreement, so yay for that.
Yeah, fair point. So my first thought with this, and we're taking this from an article that was written by Scott Bourne, who's a professional photographer and a minor Twitter personality, or I guess kind of mid-level Twitter personality. Very bright guy. I read his blog and his Twitter, but I guess that's beside the point. My first thought was, well, you can't post photos on Twitter right now. All you can do is post links to photos on Twitter, and while Twitter would have a, you know, irrevocable, non-exclusive license to do whatever it wants with the link to your photo, they wouldn't actually have any rights to the photo itself.
But
well,
Twitter is working on integrating some sort of photo feature.
For facts here, I don't think this is actually a non-revocable license.
Oh, okay. Sorry, my bad. I was just throwing that in there.
But
although, how
you know,
would you
the,
go
the
about
reason you
revoking
did that, though,
the license?
Well, the reason I think you said that, though, is because it's not uncommon to see the term irrevocable within one of these terms of service agreements. It looks like from reading the terms of service, the terms on the TwitPic TOS here, that if you delete your account, you are effectively terminating the license.
So I guess that's something we should suss out, that there are two different services, at least two different services involved. So there's Twitter itself, which for now doesn't have direct picture posting, but is rumored to be developing such. And then there's TwitPic, YFrog, all of those other services on which you can actually post photos, but have very similar terms to Twitter, that, you know, if you post a photo on TwitPic, they get a non-exclusive worldwide license to do whatever the heck they want with your photo.
Yeah, the TwitPic terms of service are almost word for word, very similar. It says, for clarity, you retain all of your ownership rights in your content. However, by submitting content to TwitPic, you hereby grant TwitPic a worldwide non-exclusive royalty-free, sublicensable, and transferable license to use, reproduce, distribute, etc., etc., etc.
Right, and it looks like the license terminates within a commercially reasonable time after you remove or delete your media from the service, so it's not just account termination.
So I guess my question is, right now, if you were to go on Twitter.com, the new Twitter, if I think it's been rolled out to everyone by now, but if I clicked on somebody's post that had a link to a picture on it, that picture would appear using the new Twitter interface. So under the new Twitter, by posting a link to an image, are you in fact granting content? Does that mean that that picture is content under Twitter's license, that you're granting Twitter itself a license to that too?
What?
I'm sorry, maybe that wasn't clear. So right now, my conceit in the beginning was that if I'm just posting a link to a picture, I'm not granting Twitter a license for that picture itself. I'm granting Twitter a license to use the link to that picture.
Correct.
But under the new Twitter, if I click on a tweet that has a link to a picture, if it's with a certain service, Twitter will actually load that picture. Like, it does this with TwitPic. If you go to the Twitter website and click on a tweet with a picture in it, it will load that picture. In Twitter's website, without a frame, without anything, it'll just pop up there. So, because Twitter's doing this now, which it didn't used to do, do you think there's a better argument for the fact that Twitter itself has this non-exclusive worldwide license to do whatever it wants with your photograph?
Perhaps, but they'd certainly be a sub-licensee first if it was coming from a third-party service of some kind. I'm reading now that the Twitter terms of service, and within those, it's just the very top paragraph here. Let's see. They define content to be any information, text, graphics, or other materials uploaded, downloaded, or appearing on the services, collectively referred to as the content. So if you read the term appearing to mean just popping up after you click on a link that relates to, let's say, a picture that has been featured or uploaded on TwitPic, then it's possible, yeah, that there could be a separate license which also is granted to Twitter in addition to you are already granting a license to TwitPic. It's more likely to me, though, that that Twitter would be a sub-licensee from the TwitPic content first.
I'm going to disagree. That makes sense. Because the license grant says that reuse, copy, reproduce, process is a good word when you're dealing with a link and processing it into an image, adapt, modifying the link by turning it into an image, publish, transmit, display, or distribute, like, in any and all media distribution methods now known or later developed, you could argue that the new Twitter is a media distribution method. Like, I think that even now with TwitPic and the new Twitter, that's going to be enough for Twitter to obtain a non-exclusive royalty-free license on those images. At least on the version of the images, perhaps it's just a thumbnail being displayed in the Twitter stream. But I think that'll be enough. Like, I don't think you could argue that they're going to get rights to the high-resolution image that's behind the link, but they're not showing the high-resolution image in the Twitter stream. But whatever they're showing in the Twitter stream, I think they can get rights to. In fact, they have to be able to get rights to it, because if they don't have rights to it, then they're not allowed to display it in the Twitter stream, right?
Well, that's a great point, and I think that's something that was sort of left out of this article a little bit, that it's not so much that the Twitter folks, the company Twitter or TwitPic, and to the extent that those are actually separate entities, it's not that they're trying to get as many rights from you as possible, or at least not necessarily. They do have to get a lot of these rights in order just to be able to display these images and display them across from TwitPic to Twitter and do that legally. Because without that authorization, it's essentially a violation of copyright.
Yeah. All right. Anything else on this story?
I'm all set.
David's?
Yep. Also good over here.
I'm set.
But I think, actually, I do have one last quick thought, and that was a very important point you made, Dominic, in the beginning. And if you've already granted somebody else a non-exclusive license to work, it's really difficult to be able to grant an exclusive license to somebody else because the prior instance obviously obviates the latter. So that's important for people who are interested in eventually maybe assigning their copyrights to other people or creating some other form of exclusive license for the use of work, and if you're trying to make money off of it, that would be really difficult. So you might want to think twice about using some of these services, and just another reason to be thorough when you read a terms of service agreement.
Yeah, and to close, basically the point that the blogger made on Photo Focus is if this is really your business, this is your livelihood, then it's worth taking and spending that money and talking to a lawyer and making sure that what you're doing is going to be secure, because you don't want to get screwed out of an exclusive licensing agreement for millions of dollars, because they'll be like, wait a second, you posted these images on Twitter. We're not going to give you an exclusive license agreement. We'll give you this non-exclusive license agreement, which will be worth far, far less. So take the time, talk to a lawyer. Unfortunately, even if you don't agree with the law, it is still the law, and it can screw you over if you don't know how it works. On that cheery note, that concludes this podcast. I was one of your hosts, Dominic Ribey, and with me today were
Ben Snickoff,
David Liu,
and David O'Brien.
Thank you for listening. Feel free to email thoughts, comments, ideas to podcast@technicallylegal.org. Follow us on Twitter @TechLegal and visit us at technicallylegal.org.